I'm Lauren Layfield, and you're listening to Your Next Podcast. This is the podcast that brings you a different series every single week, helping you to find your new favourite show. Today, we are listening to Conflict of Interest. We've got a little bit of a history thing going on at Your Next Podcast at the minute, and today's episode fits right into that category. So, Conflict of Interest is a podcast from the Imperial War Museums where celebrities visit one of the museum sites to learn about some of the most interesting and relevant wars in our history. Guided by experts in the field and museum curators, they ask all the questions that you might want to ask yourself about these periods that we should all know a little bit more about. So this is the start of season three, and throughout this season, guests such as Susan McComa, who I love, Sanjeev Bhaskar and Rachel Paris will be taking a trip through the museum's Blavatnik Art, Film and Photography Galleries to learn about the conflicts through the history of art. And first up is journalist Helen Lewis. Enjoy.
Hi, I'm Helen Lewis. I'm a journalist and I'm a museum geek.
Hi, Helen. My name's James. I'm the head of public history at Imperial War Museums.
Helen Lewis has joined James Bulgin at Imperial War Museum London to pose the questions that many of us are too embarrassed to ask about how recent conflicts have shaped our world. In this series, we're exploring the role of the war artist, filmmaker and photographer in capturing seismic moments of contemporary history. And in this episode, we're looking at how art, photography, and film have captured different scales of destruction in the 20th century.
I remember a firefighter running up to me and asking me if he could use my phone to call his wife. Oh. And he couldn't get through, and he couldn't get through, and then he had to go. And I remember I had this phone number on my phone and thought, do I call? I don't know if I call her, or do I not?
From no man's land to mushroom clouds, we'll look at the people that have documented over 100 years of conflict.
The huts in which they suffered are destroyed by fire. We must cleanse the world of the filth and pestilence of this place.
On our way, we'll encounter artistic works that have captured some of the darkest moments in human history. All so that we leave with an understanding of the significance of art in a time of war.
There's people sitting down amidst dead bodies and people who are obviously in terrible distress, and there's one woman crying and being sick. And my immediate thought was, how could you see this and go back home and not have it haunt you forever?
All this in under an hour. I'm James Taylor, and this is Conflict of Interest. It is a crisp autumnal afternoon, and James and Helen are making their way towards Imperial War Museum, London.
I love museums, but I have never been, not that I can remember, to the Imperial War Museum, which is strange because I lived in South London for a long time.
Ah.
And it's, let's be honest, of all the museums, it's maybe the most impressive looking from the outside, right?
Well, we like to think so.
I'm interested to see a gallery here that is specifically focused on something thematically.
Okay.
I think that's a really nice, to break out one slice.
Yeah.
Right, rather than trying to either give you the kind of iconic highlight or to give you the kind of waterfront, I guess galleries can be a bit more quirky, can't they? They can be a bit more led by individual taste.
Are you surprised that the Imperial War Museum has a substantial art gallery as part of its public offer?
It's not something I would have thought about, but it makes a lot of sense to me because people have always been fascinated by, even before war photography, war paintings, you know, having official artists. I'm pretty sure the army had an official artist, didn't
they? They did.
Does it
yeah,
still
yeah.
have one
There's
now?
The War Artists Commission. Yeah, yeah, they did. We'll see some of that inside. Perhaps it is something which a lot of people don't necessarily know, that the museum has a really substantial and actually, you know, significant collection of art, which, as you say, bears witness to over a century of conflict now.
Helen and James will be joined by a third voice, Suzanne Plunkett, Reuters chief photographer for the UK and Ireland, and a photojournalist for almost 30 years.
I spent two long assignments in Kabul, in Afghanistan, after the war in 2002 and 2003.
And we've got some of Suzanne's work in
here,
right?
Yeah, which is amazing. It's such an incredible thing to be able to see this work with the person who created it.
We have arrived at our first object. On certain podcast apps, you can glance at your phone as you listen to see some of the works we're discussing.
So I'm presuming that this is a First World War painting. We've got a few bits of kind of concrete and pillars and what looks like kind of corrugated iron, and then all these tree stumps that have just been cut off kind of 6 feet from the ground. It is a landscape of total destruction. And the colour scheme reflects that too, right? That it's very muted tones, but then it has these patches of ochre. It's like it's almost like the human-made bits are kind of leaving the landscape. But am I right?
You're not wrong. It's a painting called Men in Road by an artist called Paul Nash. It's interesting that you see it as a, you know, completely just about a rural landscape, because actually what it relates to in its historic context is the Battle of Men in Road. So there was a road. But the road itself has been completely subsumed, which is one of the things that Nash was really kind of interested in portraying, the total level of destruction. All of the kind of the nature has almost been obliterated, and we just see its sort of fragments remaining.
Suzanne, does this look like any landscape that you've photographed in your career?
It does. I covered the Indian Ocean tsunami in 2005, and I remember feeling like you can't get a photograph to show the scale. You know, and it was not until we got into a helicopter and could kind of see from above, but even then there was no human element, so it did feel like it just went on and on and on.
It's kind of interesting, isn't it? Because we always, you know, and perfectly reasonably, you know, surmise that we're kind of at the whim of nature, because nature has this kind of extraordinary strength and power. But here we see that humanity has almost kind of demonstrated its own capacity to be as destructive as nature. And I suppose that's one of the things which is so significant about 20th century conflict, modern conflict, and this is at the front edge of that. You know, this idea that battles aren't kind of contained, that these wars are so huge and vast, they have the capacity to completely destroy.
What year would he have painted this?
So this was just immediately after the war. So Nash had served in the war. He'd actually had this sort of strange quirk of fate that he had been serving as an officer in 1917 in Ypres. And his unit had happened to have a relatively quiet time whilst they were there. He, at one strange moment, stumbled over and broke a rib in the trench, so he was taken off the line. And after he'd gone back to recuperate, his unit was wiped out in an attack, or virtually completely wiped out. So he escaped it, you know, in one of those really strange quirks of fate that he just happened to break a rib, which took him away. When he came back to the front, he came back as an official war artist. So he was there to observe. And he painted this afterwards. And it's really interesting because as this was happening, his own relationship to his kind of beliefs about the conflict were changing quite substantially too.
That story is so interesting to me because I've just noticed that there is one tree still standing, right? Mm-hmm. Amid all of the other trees have been wiped out, which is kind of presumably what, to some extent, he must have felt like. He was the and lots of men in that war must have felt like, I'm the one person I knew who came home.
But particularly given, you know, the broader context in which this happens in 1917, it's really difficult to overestimate how significant the Battle of the Somme had been the year before, you know, 1916, which had been this huge loss of life and huge number of casualties in this battle on the first day, and then that sustained itself over the, you know, the weeks and months that followed. So it's the sort of story of the First World War, really, that, you know, it was a kind of a paradigmatic moment. You know, suddenly mankind demonstrates that it has this propensity almost to create this sort of total destruction. As you say, it meant that even if there was never quite a lost generation, which is one of the myths that emerged from the war, it was certainly the case that virtually everybody would have known somebody who'd been lost. And it really kind of laid waste to a lot of the big ideas that had underpinned Western civilization, certainly British civilization and culture. This idea, you know, this idea is the certainty of the rightness of everything. And, you know, the likes of Freud and Marx and all these people were coming through and challenging these pre-existing, you know, Nietzsche's coming. So there's a lot happening at the same time. And you do see this sense that somehow who we are has changed and our relationship to ourselves has fundamentally changed.
But also that I think you're right, that if you think about modernism being an artistic and a literary movement about the kind of, it was about destruction, right? It was about throwing away formal old rules, that maybe this was a time when they felt, hang on a minute, actually things are going to change in social ways, which they did. I mean, I wrote about this in my book. Women moving into factories and jobs, mm-hmm. You come out of this in 1918, women get the vote, women get the right to sit as magistrates. You know, they have often, throughout the First World War, been earning their own wages. The kind of the social disruptions of the 20s are quite hard to understand unless you understand that, you know, you moved a huge population of men to another country and the women kind of were left behind doing different things. And I wrote about them. the women's football teams during the First World War that happened in the factories. They had ladies' football teams because the FA suspended the men's league. And one of them, Dick Kerr Ladies, went on a tour exactly of a battlefield like this. You know, immediately after the war had ended, they went and played French players who all played in berets, which I find very charming. but the descriptions in their diaries of what it was like to just drive through mile after mile of France that was had been just blitzed, run over, you know, and there were just tiny little pockets of villages, but still littered with barbed wire. Yeah. I don't think it's hard now to appreciate, you know, even when we see images of war on TV, what it's like to just everywhere, as far as the eye can see, has been destroyed.
Yeah, there's that. And Graves has that line, and it's the title for his book, Goodbye to All That. And obviously he's talking about something specific, but I would think it pertains so well to that whole sentiment of saying that's all gone. That our version of the world and the certainty of the structures of kind of gender norms and class
norms. And aristocracy norms, as well,
all
right?
Of this.
The great houses suddenly, you know, fall into disrepair. Labour costs are much higher because there's fewer men of working age. It's what kind of, it's what ends Edwardian Britain, isn't it? And then the Britain that emerges from it is very different.
Yeah. There's, you know, Freud has this whole kind of man is no longer master in his own home, this idea that even our certainty of self can't be relied upon anymore. So the First World War kind of demonstrates this. But what is, in retrospect, really chilling is that actually this augured in the age of something much bigger. And you're talking about, you know, some of the wars since the, and, you know, things like the tsunami, you suddenly realise that this is not an aberrance. This is actually the start of something. This is, you know, humanity kind of defining new terms under which it will exist.
James, I'm loving this. This is like the classiest guided tour ever. This is my dream, my absolute dream. Like you get someone to ask them questions personally and they can't run away.
We move on from modernism to something with a touch of surrealism. Again, if you check your phone on certain podcast apps, you can see what Helen sees.
Well, instantly when I saw this, I thought it's got the air of a René Magritte or a Salvador Dali. There's something surrealist about it. You've got bits of broken walls and a bit of a face of a statue. Someone maybe bathing half naked in a lake. There's also a peeled off poster. And then I'm not quite sure what's happening on the right hand side. It looks like sort of wallpaper has come up a wall somehow. But there are a lot of slightly confusing elements. It's not giving me a lot of help about what it's about. James, help me.
Yeah, no, sure, I can completely understand that. The picture relates specifically to the Spanish Civil War and specifically to the bombing of Guernica as part of the Spanish Civil War.
So that's 1930s?
And
that's Guernica as in, which people will have heard of in the sense of the Pablo Picasso mm-hmm. giant painting. So mm-hmm. this is the same incident.
It's the same incident, but it's a really significant incident. The Spanish Civil War is one of those wars which has kind of perhaps receded a little in the kind of public, popular imagination or the collective memory. But really significant for a number of different reasons, not least because the bombing of Guernica was this, again, kind of enormous transgression. You know, the first time that there was widespread bombing of civilians in an urban target like that, it ushers in a new era. So there's a noticeable difference from the subjects that Nash was working with, which are to do with sort of spaces of conflict, which is not to say that civilians weren't caught up in the First World War, of course they were. But moving into this space, suddenly there's this new dimension of human experience whereby bombs can drop from the air. And, you know, we might think about that today as being a given, you know, because that's pretty well established. But putting ourselves back in the position of the 1930s where something like that has never happened before is huge.
But it's still pretty terrifying, isn't it? Because now the thing I think that people find hard is the idea of unmanned, you know, drones, mm-hmm. essentially, and the idea that someone can be sitting at essentially like a video games controller in the middle of Nevada and they're killing people thousands of miles away.
Yeah, exactly, but very much born out of this sort of initial moment where that kind of Rubicon is crossed. So what we see here is in contrast to the Nash painting, the fragments, the sort of shards of human spaces, in a way that human spaces are more absent from the Nash painting. It's almost like the focus of conflict is becoming more about the role and the positionality of the civilian in conflict and their sort of fundamental vulnerability under the sort of the weight of modern war. The artist himself, John Armstrong, wasn't there during the Spanish Civil War, but it had this huge impression on that whole generation because, of course, the other thing about the Spanish Civil War, which is kind of extraordinarily romantic in its own way, is that all these artists from across the world obviously went over there en masse.
Yeah, and George Orwell too, right? Mm-hmm. Turns up and on the front lines, gets shot in the neck and ends up having to be invalided out. But there was a sense that it was you know, there was a movement behind it, right? That it was happening in someone else's country, but it was part of a kind of political movement that young avant-garde people would ally themselves to.
Exactly, and it really kind of activated and motivated this generation of artists together. And in fact, Paul Nash established a group called Unit One, which was quite short-lived, but Armstrong was a part of it. So there was a connection between those two artists, and then Armstrong becomes this person who's kind of one of many people galvanised by the Spanish Civil War. But I was thinking this painting, for me, you get this on the floor here, there's this sort of fragment of what looks like a statue.
But huge, right? That's what threw me about. I don't know, Suzanne, did you also, when you looked at this, think this has a slight surrealism to it? Because the bit of the statue is just so vast that it almost just doesn't feel like it belongs in the same way to the rest of the painting.
Yeah, it looks like the painting is in layers. Which photojournalists always kind of try to strive to get layers into their work. But it does look like a Dali or a de Chirico, but it's got this kind of sinister edge. You know, you just feel like something wrong has happened, even though it's just in the posters that are the expressions of the people that are...
Yeah, people screaming in the posters or shouting, and then a tree half growing out of what looks like rock.
Yeah.
Have you ever had a situation somewhere you've taken a photo and you've seen something in it that just profoundly feels like it doesn't belong there?
So I haven't been on a front line, but I've photographed the aftermath and almost daily life after. And you'll see sort of when I was in Afghanistan, I remember being in towns where, you know, people are going about their daily life. And meanwhile, you know, the buildings are falling apart, they're in pieces, and there's still people with, you know, Kalashnikovs walking down the street casually, and you're saying good morning to them and thinking, well, what's going on? Exactly. Yeah.
One of the problems I'm guessing about photographing the aftermath of conflict is we have such a well-established idea about the kind of visual cliches of it, that trying to find the freshness in that, that actually tells a new story and an accurate story rather than slotting
those
into...
cliches which you don't want to fall into, and trying to find the human story to sort of, pin to the wider theme.
But that whole concept of incongruousness as well is really, really important, I think. You know, clearly that's something which Armstrong had in mind as he's working on this. But that sort of surrealism, we're talking about Dali, etc., like, I think it does suggest that there is something broader going on to do with representation, and almost like the kind of escalating crisis of representation, that the sort of mimetic form of art, which, you know, the Nash is still in its own way, mimetic, you still recognise it as a landscape. You don't need to be told that. Whereas for this one, we recognise elements and fragments of it, but its composition is disorientating. It is incongruous, and there is an incongruity about this. And I would sort of feel like, in a way, this bit of statue suggests like the destruction of the great cultures. Do you know what I mean? It looks like it's come from...
It does feel like Roman or Greek, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
I almost feel like in places I've been, this could exist.
Right. Huh.
You know, like, at first when I looked at this, I went, it's surreal. It wouldn't ever be. When you look at a Dali, you know, there's melting clocks and it's crazy. But when you look at this, this could exist.
Well, the physics almost hold firm, don't they? The physics seem authentic and plausible. It's just their composition.
Just has a deep sense of wrongness about it, doesn't it, this painting, which I think was what makes it kind of compelling, is it conveys an emotion and a mood as much as visual information. So was the Spanish Civil War one of the first wars to be exhaustively covered, if it was attracting all these artists and writers?
Yeah,
wasn't Hemingway with there as well?
Hemingway there.
What it also did is, on a historical level, is kind of introduce the world, and Guernica's a part of that, but to the realities of what modern war was likely to be like. So it sort of precedent, I suppose, when the Second World War followed. That's not to suggest there was any kind of direct relationship or causality or anything of that nature, but it meant that the types of weapons that would be used in the Second World War were witnessed in the Spanish Civil War, and it really kind of gave people an enormous cause for concern, because whilst nobody could have possibly predicted the course of the Second World War, or indeed whether or not it would actually happen at all, nevertheless it did suggest that if there were to be another world war, it would be of a very, very different order.
I think it's hard for us to remember now, but if you were alive in 1910, you know, you might have been born when the Civil War happened, right? So the Civil War in America in the 1860s, which is still people lining up across a field and walking at each other.
Yeah.
And you're life could have covered that just incredible industrialization of mm-hmm. war. Mm-hmm. So there would have been people around for whom this was, you know, just completely new and not the way that things had been done.
For sure. And you know, you've got to remember, even things like flight, you know, for the First World War, like the RAF was only formed during the First World War. You know, the idea of aeroplanes being used in combat was new because aeroplanes themselves were, you know, pretty new.
And presumably such a souring of a dream in the sense that you read people writing in the 1890s and 1900s about things like, you know, electricity and industrialization. And that was, you know, it was this huge, exciting engine of progress. And mm-hmm. then you begin to see through the First World War and then the Spanish Civil War, the downside of that, which is you can do everything much more efficiently and at much greater scale, including killing people.
We move on. This time, to one of the darkest moments in human history. Helen and Suzanne witness a newsreel from the end of the Second World War, filmmakers educating Allied audiences on the Nazi genocide of the Jewish race.
Here in Belsen, just one of their concentration camps, people are still dying at the rate of 40 a day. German soldiers under a British guard carry the pitiful dead from the huts in which they had been herded. These men died from deliberate starvation and neglect. It was too late to save them. They were too weak to take food or respond to medical care.
The Holocaust Memorial Day focuses on the liberation of Auschwitz, and there are good reasons for that, and Auschwitz has become this kind of real focus of Holocaust memory, and there are good reasons for that too. Belsen, for Britain, is particularly significant because Belsen was liberated by British forces.
So where is it in Poland, in
Germany? No, it's Germany. It's an unusual site, actually. Belsen, for the majority of its existence, didn't exist as a concentration camp in the way that other sites did. It was a transit camp, and it was a site where so-called privileged Jews were kept, or exchanged Jews, in the hope and anticipation that they could kind of be swapped as part of kind of grotesque deals on the behalf of the Nazis.
As the Allied forces closed in on Germany from both the east and west, the Nazis began a grim evacuation of concentration camps, moving prisoners deeper into the Reich. This retreat resulted in the harrowing death marches, columns of emaciated prisoners forced to travel long distances under brutal conditions. Many succumbed to exhaustion, starvation, and violence, with around a third dying on the journey. These marches marked a catastrophic final chapter of the Holocaust. By the time the survivors reached Germany, the shrinking territory left fewer sites to hold them, amplifying the horror.
Belsen became the site to which the majority of people were evacuated just because it was the most sort of convenient, I suppose, given other things that were going on. So what it meant is that at the point of liberation, in April 1945, there were about 60,000 prisoners in Belsen with virtually no provision for them. That's far, far, far more than any other site of that nature. What had also happened at that stage is that the Nazis or Germany had completely lost control of the whole system, i.e. communications networks were breaking down, supply lines were breaking down, etc. So they weren't able to do anything to support or sustain that population at all. So when these people arrived, there was absolutely nothing there for them.
I think one of the most shocking things about the footage is the bit when you go from seeing the prisoners, who have obviously in most cases starved to death, mm-hmm. to seeing the camp commandant who looks sleek and plump and all the women who work there, and just the kind of the shocking difference. Visuals bring that home to you in a way that a written description even maybe wouldn't.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things I think about the footage, which is so significant, and the Belsen footage is, it, you know, sort of dominates all of this liberation footage because there's so much of it, because there were so many people there, and the AFPU, the Army Film and Photography Unit, was there to capture it. It's really sort of defined the way that we think about these things in a lot of ways. But what I always think is really striking about it is it's so striking, as you say, and so immediate that it has sort of, in a way, indulged this myth that the Allies knew nothing about these things until they arrived at the gates, which of course they did. They had a really comprehensive knowledge of what was going on throughout. But exactly as you say, there was something about seeing it or being able to visualise it, mm-hmm. which was transformative. And so I always think, you know, we can talk about versions of knowing. we can know intellectually, but to know because we see it is transformative.
The other image that I find just very striking just now is there's people sitting down amidst dead bodies and people who are obviously in terrible distress, and there's one woman crying and being sick. And the interesting thing is that's not everybody, right? Well, I don't know how you felt when you saw this, Suzanne, but I thought, my immediate thought was, how could you see this and go back home and not have it haunt you forever?
Do you put your camera down and help, or do you take pictures in hopes that it will bring help in?
Right.
I mean, I find that the story of, you know, Kevin Carter, who took the very famous photo during the famine of the child being stalked by a vulture and was then won a Pulitzer for it, but then was then haunted by the question of, and what happened next? And he couldn't answer that. To me, that kind of encapsulates the photojournalist dilemma, right? Which is, what are you there to do, right? Are you there to record it for posterity, or do you have to put your humanity aside to some extent to do that because you're a kind of emissary of the rest of the world to bring this stuff home?
Right, and he ended up, he did help the child, but I think it became sort of this, it felt like he was bullied, you know, by people not understanding and jumping on seeing these photographs, thinking, you know, that's kind of when the conversation started for a lot of photographers.
I mean, there are really difficult ethical questions which continue to exercise anyone working with this content and this footage about, you know, what you should or shouldn't use. You know, I mean, I think you're seeing people in such terrible levels of suffering and degradation and their bodies, you know, particularly people who haven't obviously had the ability to give their consent to be filmed. Something which we talked to a lot of different people about when we were working on the galleries and consulted a lot about, because on one hand it exists within the historical record, so to sort of not use it means that you're kind of eliding that part of the archive. But on the other, you do run the risk of sort of further exploiting people who have already been so egregiously exploited and assaulted in their lives.
How much of this made it back to Britain? I mean, obviously there was a huge amount of footage collected, but were people able to see it? Were they? I mean, not happy to see it, but were they? You know, were they in a place to be able to receive and understand that this stuff had happened?
Yeah, they were. I mean, I think it sort of made itself kind of felt and seen in various different forms. I mean, it was obviously front page of the newspapers was a big thing. And like, for example, the Josef Kramer, who you were just alluding to just there, who was the commandant of Belsen, who extraordinarily, and this is a whole other story, you know, chose to stay in post when he knew that the Allies were coming, because, Belsen, when it was liberated, was still behind enemy lines. And there was this concern about... from the Germans, obviously entirely about their self-interest concern from them, that if the Allies were to sort of fight through into Belsen and the prisoners were allowed to escape, then typhus would become rampant because there was so much typhus within the camp. So they brokered this kind of agreement that Belsen would be sort of within the zone of protection, which is how the Allies arrived there. And Cromwell was still at his post when he got there. But then in the British press, he became known as the Beast of Belsen. Mm. And these sort of various titles come out quite often, you know, very gendered and quite misogynist. There's, you know, Irma Graeser became the Beastess of Belsen, the Bitch of Belsen. So all these various sort of names associated with it. So the pictures were in the papers, the film was seen in newsreels, etc. And it did have a really significant impact on the way that people thought about things. And what it also became, and it was a post-rationalisation, but it became something which really rationalised the entire war. You know, there's this whole sense of saying, and this proves what we were fighting for.
That was even, I think, in the voiceover, you know, which was, you know, if it hadn't been for the Battle of Britain, looking at a pile of bodies, this could have been you.
I noticed that was very...
Yeah, it's quite unapologetic.
It's obviously a very strong patriotic kind of spin on it, that you could see that the people not being allowed to just digest these images as they were delivered with a message behind them.
Yeah, but the Holocaust is a real problem in the kind of collective memory, in that there's almost sort of two, you know, a number of scholars have talked about this, two different versions of the Holocaust. There's the version of the Holocaust that actually happened, and there's the version of the Holocaust that's been sort of reconstructed in culture. So, you know, films and...
There's always a mythology with any event that is that big and happens on such a massive scale. Yeah.
Exactly, but the sort of challenge with the Holocaust is that sort of quote-unquote myth of the Holocaust, and that, you know, that's how Tim Cole describes it as well, is almost completely displaced the actual historic ones. So the details and the references and the understanding that people have gleaned from all of those kind of mythologized versions have really distracted from the reality of what occurs. And I think the Belsen footage makes this point, actually. One of my big kind of concerns about kind of some of the cultural recreations of the subjects is that they really tend towards this obsession with the idea of systemization and bureaucratization and that kind of thing. Whereas I think actually the Holocaust was far more messy, iterative, you know, brutal.
Right, which is what the zone of interest tried to capture, right? The idea that it was happening next door to people's gardens, that you had to actively ignore, that something weird was happening at the end of your road.
Yeah, and of course people didn't. I mean, I think, you know, again, this idea is one of those sort of prevailing myths, then, and it became obviously a natural defence mechanism afterwards to say, oh, I didn't know about it. Even at Nuremberg, senior Nazis were seeking to make that case. It really doesn't bear any close scrutiny. In fact, one of the things we display in the galleries is a letter from a lady called Eleanor Gusenbauer, who lived near Mauthausen concentration camp. And she wrote to the commandant at Mauthausen during its operation, and she said, and it was a letter of complaint to him, she said it was very distressing for her as a you know, civilian living nearby to have to witness and listen to prisoners dying these protracted, agonising deaths. And what she said is she would be much more happy if they could either kill them quickly or do it away from public gaze so that she doesn't have to deal with it.
We move again to another scene of destruction.
So I'm looking at a black and white photo of a mushroom cloud, and I'm presuming this is a test fire, you know, one of the ones in the Pacific. Is that what I'm looking at, one of the very first tests?
No, this is the actual one over Nagasaki.
Oh, wow.
This is the real thing, yeah. Nagasaki was obviously the second of the bombs that was dropped. Part of a series of events that have this massive significance for humanity. You know, we were talking previously about science and the role of science and conflict and technology, etc. And, you know, the atomic science was such a critical part of the scientific movement in the early part of the last century. And at first there were these hopes that it had this, you know, propensity or this potential for humanity to revolutionise everything and to allow us to be our kind of better selves and everything. That's, of course, what actually happened is the atomic bomb was created. And in extraordinarily quick order. I mean, it's really easy to lose sight of this, that this science was moving so fast, mm-hmm. so fast. And this group of scientists, which is a project which started in this country, actually, which again gets forgotten. I'm not saying that that's something we should be proud of, but I think it's, you know, it's important
it's
to know
strange
that
strange helpful leather, isn't it? I was reading about William Shockley, the physicist, and there was something very strange happened that basically all of the, you know, the in the physics community in the kind of late 1930s and 1940s in America, suddenly they all just vanished to Los Alamos,
yeah.
right? And then no one heard from them. But there must have been that incredible sense in the community, oh, something's up.
Yeah, and these extraordinarily smart people. You know, as you say, the sort of people who would, in other circumstances, have been in laboratories and nobody would have heard of. They'd have just been getting on with their stuff and making these really important discoveries, but suddenly they all convened in this place.
Susanna, can I ask you about how you feel about the aesthetic qualities of this image? Because it's obviously, I presume, taken out of a plane, is
yeah,
that right?
Yeah.
But it's quite badly cropped, I don't mean to...
It is.
Be
niggly. It's niggling me a bit. Okay. And
so you're cutting off a bit of the mushroom cloud, and it takes a moment. Now we know it's an iconic shape, we sort of know what it is, but it actually doesn't convey a lot of visual information itself. What did it make you think when you first saw it?
Well, at first, yeah, I thought the crop was bad, but I thought, how did they get that picture? Because...
Yeah.
If that was the actual one, that is that so close? And how did the person in the plane survive? And it must have just been taken really fast.
Really fast. No, there's a lot of risk for them as they were doing these things because, of course, you know, the nature and scale of the blast for these things is massive. So they were various sort of manoeuvres that they had to follow once the device had been dropped, and they had these kind of sunglasses and stuff in order to, you know, protect their eyes and stuff. So I suppose, in a way, the poorness of the framing evidences the sort of the liveness of the moment, because they would have just had to grab the shot and then get out of there.
That makes sense.
Yeah, and not knowing how big it was going to be. I mean, what always strikes me about these things is that they are, if you didn't know what was beneath it, there's almost like a sort of an ethereal beauty about it. You know, this the shape and the form. It's just it's the knowledge that beneath it is such.
And there's this reflection and the, yeah.
And to be a photographer in that situation, I can't imagine there's anything comparable in your career that you just look at and think, no human in history has ever looked at this before. It doesn't happen that often.
Yeah, this was only the third bomb. You know, they did the one, the Trinity test, before they left, and then there's the bomb in Hiroshima and then Nagasaki. So, that, I mean, this is the third time this had happened.
My grandfather was in World War II, and he was in Bimini when they did a test.
Okay.
And it made a huge impact on him. He talked about it endlessly, and with me, he wanted me to have this photograph before he died so I could kind of go out and tell the world exactly what happened. He was very, very shaken by it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the strange things about it is within the context of the war, there had been more people killed in bombing raids, in conventional bombing raids in Japan than were killed during the atomic bombs. So I sometimes wonder if it's sort of the clarity of the difference it made emerged slightly later. But it clearly changed everything.
I presume that in some ways, the morality of that was like, we have to end this war before, you know, we're still ahead.
It turned out that the Germans were nowhere near it.
But that's one of the great ironies, isn't it, of the Holocaust, is the fact that so many brilliant European scientists had all left because they were Jewish. And there's that description of it as being essentially a Hungarian school science fair project, right, the Manhattan Project. But the Nazis fell behind technologically because they had driven out their best scientists through racism. It's an extraordinary historical irony.
Yeah, they denied themselves the capacity through their own sort of prejudice and bigotry, yeah. I mean, and, you know, thank God they did, because it's, I mean, obviously, the ends never justify the means in that respect, but I do shudder to think sometimes what would have happened had Hitler had the bomb at his disposal.
We have come to our last object, two photographs taken by one of today's guests.
So, Suzanne, we've finally come to your pictures from your time reporting on 9/11, on the terror attacks that took down the World Trade Center. And the thing that first of all strikes me is it's almost like the bottom one is almost like a kind of a blizzard, like it's a snowfall. You know, people are covering their mouths, they're running away, but there's just so much dust hanging in the air. And the same is true of the other one, which is of someone being interviewed, but the streets are white. It's, and I have to say, is that one of your abiding memories of that day? I always wonder, what did it smell like? It must have smelled like burning as well, right?
It was a horrible smell. And it was, you know, my overriding memories are just of complete confusion, but trying to make sense of it. I came out of this subway station sort of about a few minutes before the towers came down. And I remember looking up and you could see the towers. I was about two blocks away and you could see them. And at that point, the planes had gone in and I was thinking, how are they gonna put out that fire? Like, we didn't really, you know, we weren't really thinking what it was. I wasn't thinking terrorism. So I came out of that subway station and was setting my camera settings for the, you know, beautiful sunny day. And then someone yelled, they're coming down. And I was thinking it would fall like, you know, a tree in the forest. You don't know which way it's going to go. And I was not 110 stories away from, you know, so I thought it's going to come and hit me. I ran and hid under a car and then kind of had that moment of like, this is not going to do anything. This is not going to work. And sort of then just got out from under the car and you could hear kind of this huge noise. It was really loud. And then it was just quiet.
Was it like metal groaning noise? That's what I feel like I can remember from TV reports at the time. Just this kind of sort of wail of kind of steel coming apart.
Yeah, you can hear. I found the recording of exactly at that moment where I had photographed some people kind of running away in horror. And you can hear just things, you know, breaking and falling and screaming. And then it's just absolutely quiet. So in this picture here, the one that looks like a blizzard, it was just absolute silence. No one knew what to do. And I remember thinking, I need to capture the horror of this, and this is a recurring thing, and showing the scale, and just sort of wandering around.
That's what's interesting
lower Manhattan.
To me, because it's one of those things that's hard to put yourself back at the time that it happened, right? Because it became so much a justification for the war in Iraq, and therefore so politicized. But you didn't have any idea about that, or any idea about the way that, you know, that your photographs could later be used. What did you think you needed to get down on film? Like, what was the thing that you thought, this is important, this is what I... Like, what are the things that you were drawn to photographing?
It was everything, because it was such a strange scene.
Right.
You know, it wasn't your everyday. It was, you know, you can see people, there was women without shoes, people with shoes in this dust. People weren't crying and screaming, and that's what I was looking for. Right. It felt like there was this sort of silence, and everyone was probably just as confused as I was.
But you're right, it's the detail. So the guy that's being interviewed on TV is still clutching a can of soda.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just like he's sort of cracked open a Sprite or something.
Well, that guy is using his newspaper to try and filter.
Yeah, and there was this cough that you had after. It was sort of the 9/11 cough, and everybody had this horrible cough, and you knew who was down there and who wasn't. And I remember taking this picture because I wasn't used to... Well, this was before mobile phones, so it was almost like this last generation of photographers who were capturing iconic images. You know, we weren't taking selfies of each other. We weren't photographing ourselves. And I remember thinking, oh, this is a weird picture, but I don't know, I'm going to shoot everything.
Right.
And thinking, why am I taking a picture of the reporter?
And you were shooting on film as well.
Do that. No, this was digital.
It was digital.
This was an early digital camera, and that's why they're so small, is the file sizes were very small. Yeah.
Interesting.
When did you send your photos in to... It was AP you were working for at the time.
It was, yeah. I probably took pictures for about 20 minutes and then thought, I have to get these on the wire. And I went into this sort of vitamin/beeper shop, one of those, New York kind of places. And they were letting people in and then they closed the gate and people were almost like banging to get in the shop because we thought this is before the second tower had fallen. And so we were taking shelter and it was... crammed, and I was saying, can I use a phone line? And I thought, and can I plug my laptop in, thinking I need to keep my laptop charged today. Right. I don't know what I'm going to see. And took out my enormous mobile phone, connected it to my laptop, sent 3 pictures. That was all I could get out. And that was when my office went, she's okay.
Oh,
thank God. And then, my parents were calling, and they could tell them, she's all right, we see pictures. And I did not take as many pictures now if I had gone back. Now you shoot 3,000 pictures at a football match, and I probably took about 500 pictures that day.
Do you have an emotional response to seeing that?
I do. I feel like I do get a shaky feel whenever I talk about it. I sort of start feeling shaky and almost cold. I don't know, it's chilling, and just going right back there. It was such a vivid memory of the day, every single thing that went on. I remember a firefighter running up to me and asking me if he could use my phone to call his wife. And he couldn't get through. And then he had to go. And he dashed towards the ground zero. At that time, I didn't, And I remember I had this phone number on my phone and thought, and for weeks I was like, do I call? I don't know if I call her or do I not? Did he survive? I don't know who he is.
And you still don't know?
I still don't know, no.
Our time at the gallery is almost at an end. But there's just time for a cup of tea in the cafe and a chance to decompress.
I think what will stay with me from looking around that gallery is the difficulty of capturing the scale of war and actually that ability to stand back and put it in perspective, that war is simultaneously something that happens to individual people, often changing their lives forever, ending their lives, but also that it is something kind of a mass event. And also that it's something that happens to the people back home, and there is always a kind of contest about what images that they're getting beamed back to them. And the difficulty of, working in dangerous situations to tell the truth. I think it's about the hardest place to kind of claim that images are true. And photojournalism is always a huge debate about what does kind of truth really mean? Can you ever capture the totality of a situation in a single image? And in war, that is just so much harder than anyone else. You're always shooting it from your perspective, which isn't by definition a limited perspective. One of the things I'm really going to take away is now, I think, from people born in Western Europe in the second half of the 20th century, have had one of the most conflict-free existences of anybody in human nature. And that's not the default experience of humanity. And that's why great to come to a museum like this, because war is almost not the natural state of humanity, but it is something that has been a constant throughout human history. And we're deluding ourselves if we think it's gone away. Maybe the Ukraine war has changed how people feel about that, but in the same way that 9/11, I think, changed how many Americans felt about violence and destruction, that it was something that, it happens here, it happens in Manhattan, and that's not ever something you've ever experienced before. James, Suzanne, thank you so much for being my guides to the gallery and to what it's like to be a photojournalist. I mean, it was very mind-expanding, which is what I always hope for when I come to a museum. And to me, the crazy thing about it is that I just I've scratched the surface of the Imperial War Museum. We were walking through the galleries on our way there, and I kept wanting to go off and go, oh, that's an exploded tank. That looks really interesting. So this is my first visit, but it will not be my last visit to the museum.
Good.
And that's where we must leave this conflict of interest and the Blavatnik Art, Film and Photography Gallery. Thanks to our guests, Helen Lewis, Suzanne Plunkett and James Bulgin. Next week on Conflict of Interest.
And also there's the loss of life, isn't there? If you're asking people from the colonies to come and fight and then they don't come back.
Absolutely,
it's
yes.
Just, you know, what then happens?
Actor Susan Wacoma discovers the artist depicting the changing face of the British home front. My name is James Taylor. The producer was Matt Hill at Rethink Audio, with support from Eleanor Head, Daniel Ben-Corin, and the IWM Institute team at Imperial War Museums. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
As I say, there's so many more great guests coming up on this series. Episode 2 is out tomorrow, so do go and follow Conflict of Interest to make sure you don't miss an episode. And before you do that, make sure you follow your next podcast right here so you don't miss a thing from me. You can find all my recommendations along with news, reviews and much more on Podcast Rex at www.podcastrex.com. That's www.podcastrex.com.